Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The guilty verdict against a Syrian intelligence official adjudged to have been behind torture and killings of detainees during the country's ongoing civil war has been widely welcomed by the UN's human rights system. High Commissioner Michelle Bachelet hailed the historic conviction of the 58-year-old defendant, identified only as Anwar R., by a German court in Koblenz on Thursday. He was convicted of crimes against humanity for killings, serious deprivation of liberty, rape, sexual assault, and hostage taking. No matter where you are or how senior you may be, if you perpetrate torture or other serious human rights violations, you will be held accountable sooner or later, at home or abroad, the UN rights chief said, describing the development as a landmark leap forward in the pursuit of truth, justice, and reparations for violations perpetrated in Syria over more than a decade. After a six-week surge, Africa's fourth pandemic wave that's been mainly driven by the Omicron variant is flattening, the World Health Organization, WHO, said on Thursday. The WHO said that this marked the shortest surge since the pandemic began on the continent, where total cases have exceeded 10.2 million. Recorded cases of infection show that the weekly number plateaued in the 7 days leading up to the 9th of January from the previous week. Southern Africa saw a huge increase in infections during the Omicron wave, but recorded a 14% decline in confirmed cases over the past week. And South Africa, where Omicron was first reported, saw a 9% fall in weekly infections. East and Central African regions also experienced falling numbers of cases, but North and West Africa are seeing a rise, with North Africa reporting a 121% increase this past week compared with the previous 7 days. Head of the UN Health Agency, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, has spoken out over continuing blockades on life-saving humanitarian access to Ethiopia's Tigray region. Tedros said that despite the best efforts of the World Health Organization, WHO, it has been prevented from sending medicine for basic life-saving procedures.
We're deeply concerned from WHO side. We have tried all our best, but we're blocked from sending medicines to Tigray, Ethiopia. And that's so dreadful and unimaginable during this time, 21st century, when a government is denying its own people for more than a year food and medicine and the rest to survive.
It is now more than 14 months since conflict erupted between Ethiopian federal forces and those loyal to the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front. Tigray has been under siege for more than a year, Tedros told journalists from Geneva, before noting that WHO teams have been allowed to send medicines to Afar and Amhara regions. Daniel Johnson, UN News. Hello, in this week's show, the latest on the emergency relief effort in the Philippines after the destructive passage of Super Typhoon Rai. Deep concern about the blockade of medicines to Ethiopia's Tigray, a landmark judgment against a Syrian interrogator who's been found guilty of crimes against humanity, and Omicron on the African continent, where infections look to be plateauing, but not everywhere. All this and more in this week's UN Catch-Up Dateline Geneva with Solange Behatege-Cortez and me, Daniel Johnson. Thanks for listening. First, the news. The guilty verdict against a Syrian intelligence official adjudged to have been behind torture and killings of detainees during the country's ongoing civil war has been widely welcomed by the UN's human rights system. High Commissioner Michelle Bachelet hailed the historic conviction of the 58-year-old defendant, identified only as Anwar R., by a German court in Koblenz on Thursday. He was convicted of crimes against humanity for killings, serious deprivation of liberty, rape, sexual assault, and hostage-taking. No matter where you are or how senior you may be, if you perpetrate torture or other serious human rights violations, you will be held accountable sooner or later, at home or abroad, the UN rights chief said, describing the development as a landmark leap forward in the pursuit of truth, justice, and reparations for violations perpetrated in Syria over more than a decade. After a six-week surge, Africa's fourth pandemic wave that's been mainly driven by the Omicron variant is flattening, the World Health Organization, WHO, said on Thursday. The WHO said that this marked the shortest surge since the pandemic began on the continent, where total cases have exceeded 10.2 million. Recorded cases of infection show that the weekly number plateaued in the 7 days leading up to the 9th of January from the previous week. Southern Africa saw a huge increase in infections during the Omicron wave, but recorded a 14% decline in confirmed cases over the past week. And South Africa, where Omicron was first reported, saw a 9% fall in weekly infections. East and Central African regions also experienced falling numbers of cases, but North and West Africa are seeing a rise, with North Africa reporting a 121% increase this past week compared with the previous 7 days. Head of the UN Health Agency, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, has spoken out over continuing blockades on life-saving humanitarian access to Ethiopia's Tigray region. Tedros said that despite the best efforts of the World Health Organization, WHO, it has been prevented from sending medicine for basic life-saving procedures.
We're deeply concerned from WHO side. We have tried all our best, but we're blocked from sending medicines to Tigray, Ethiopia. And that's so dreadful and unimaginable during this time, 21st century, when a government is denying its own people for more than a year food and medicine and the rest to survive.
It is now more than 14 months since conflict erupted between Ethiopian federal forces and those loyal to the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front. Tigray has been under siege for more than a year, Tedros told journalists from Geneva, before noting that WHO teams have been allowed to send medicines to Afar and Amhara regions. The headlines there, and now to this week's interview, which takes us to the vast Philippines archipelago, where once popular tourist spots have been smashed to bits by Super Typhoon Rai, or Odette, as it's known locally. It's now 4 weeks since the disaster, which has left thousands homeless and farming and fishing communities reliant on handouts. Children are begging on roadsides, and survival sex is now happening too. All this in a place where people were already on their knees from COVID. Among those helping the government relief effort, the World Food Programme is there, providing nutritious supplies, solidarity, and amazing technical solutions to help coordinate the disaster response in the form of mobile telecoms networks. As we'll hear from Country Director Brenda Barton now.
The situation on the ground a month after Typhoon Odette went across an area the size of Austria is still extremely worrying for thousands and thousands of people. We have more than 7 million people who've been affected by this typhoon, and many of those people are living in the open. They do not have houses yet, or they're living in evacuation centers, which are really worrying because they're living in close confines and we have COVID that's spiraling around. The situation for the livelihoods is also very worrying because people do not have money and they're relying on relief aid. And we've seen outbreaks of diarrhea, and indeed we've seen some deaths as well. So it is really a very worrying situation, with the humanitarian community rushing aid as fast as it can, working together with the government to help communities.
So those communities most affected are farming and fishing villages. How are they surviving? What is the damage that you've seen yourself?
So what I saw was really not a boat standing. I mean, the boats had been destroyed by the rising sea tides and by what was really a combination, I would say, of a typhoon, but also a tornado effect. I mean, things were just ripped up and thrown, and the houses were razed to the ground. There was barely a building that had been untouched. And so there was really nothing left for people. I saw mountainsides that used to be full of beautiful coconut trees. They were stripped bare. They were brown. The coconuts have been destroyed. In fact, right now what people are doing is they're taking chainsaws and they're trying to, you know, make a bit of a living out of the wood that's there, but that won't last for long. So, you know, the loss of livelihood, farmland, it's extremely worrying at a time when the country was already, honestly, on its knees due to COVID and economic recession.
In your last briefing to journalists, you said that there were still some communities that were cut off. Have you reached them yet?
So there's more and more access to communities that is opening up, but my colleagues are saying that there's still areas in the rural parts of some of these smaller islands. You know, you can imagine that it is a huge amount of territory to try to reach. And people that are living outside of the main cities, many of them have not been reached with aid. We're getting reports from communities where children are standing along the roadside with signs saying, please help us, begging for food. There's concern by agencies such as the United Nations Population Fund about gender-based violence and prostitution on the rise as a coping mechanism.
Now, the UN itself is calling for $107 million. The World Food Programme wants $25 million. This is for food logistics and telecoms. Maybe you could tell us how that appeal is progressing.
So from the WFP side, we've received, I would say, about 25% of what our $25 million request was. But, you know, that's a month into this crisis. And really what we're finding is that the damage on the ground is as great as Haiyan in terms of the numbers of houses that have been damaged. It's actually more houses were damaged than Typhoon Haiyan, which was in 2013 and which killed, you know, more than 6,000 people. And the number of cities that were also touched is almost matching that of Haiyan. Yet in Haiyan, there was this huge public outcry and, you know, the aid poured in volume. Here, in this case, there were very little deaths, you know, somewhere in the realm of 500. Still one is, of course, too many, but it was low, relatively speaking, for that kind of damage. And that seems to have set off this feeling that it's not as grave as other typhoons of, you know, their magnitude.
Yes, and thank goodness the World Food Programme is there along with your partners on the ground. But people might say, listen, it's 2022. Why are these disasters still happening? Why are communities so vulnerable? Maybe you could give us some development solutions that you're providing as humanitarians to people in need at the moment.
Well, one of the things that WFP has been doing for the last year and certainly over years is to work on emergency preparedness together with the government. And there has been a lot that's been done. I mean, proof, you know, being that there were low numbers of deaths considering this kind of devastation. I mean, I came here and people said never again would they face that kind of human loss because of a typhoon. But of course, there's nothing you can do if the typhoon is as powerful as what it is and it destroys houses and, you know, telecommunications. So I think the emergency preparedness evacuation measures were really well done. The government has been quickly sending out family food packs. WFP has sent over 175,000 family food packs on trucks since the operation started. And then I think a really interesting area is on the telecommunications. So indeed, you know, right after the crisis, the telecommunications went down. That happens everywhere. Haiti earthquake, no matter where you are, that's the first thing that comes down. The government and the Department of Information and Telecommunications in particular asked the World Food Program 3 years ago to help it design and build mobile telecommunications units. And we did this together, and actually the government paid for these units in large part, which were built by WFP in Dubai, where we have our specialized hub for telecommunications. In fact, I have to add in a part. During Haiyan, WFP sent out 53 international telecommunications experts to respond. This time, we're sending out 4 or 5. So that just goes to show how much better prepared the country is. What's a really interesting story is that these mobile units were pre-positioned just earlier this year in 6 typhoon-prone parts of the country. And the idea was that as we saw a typhoon coming in, we would decide whether we would deploy these units with the government to the area that we thought would be struck. And indeed, the first deployment that we have had on these units was during this typhoon. 2 of the units arrived the day before the typhoon struck. And that meant that the next day, the telecommunications from those units was enabling the government responders and the international community, really, because it was able to tell what was going on the ground, to be up and running in a very, of course, you know, limited sense. But it got those emergency responders to be able to coordinate and communicate vital information.
Okay, well, that's fascinating about the technological solutions, and presumably this is how humanitarian work is evolving. What has this meant operationally for you? You have to seek new partners?
I mean, this kind of humanitarian response in a country like the Philippines is largely led by the government, but there's so much support that can come in and is coming in from private sector. So one of the private sector partners that we've received support from just literally yesterday sent in 2 airloads of mobile storage units for free from Malaysia, the UN response depot there, and this was the UPS Foundation. And here on the ground, there's been a big groundswell of help from private sector and a private sector umbrella that helps to organize it. So in a country where there is means like this, it's very important that the private sector step up, working with the local NGOs on the ground and with the government and other actors.
My thanks then to WFP's Brenda Barton with harrowing news on the plight of communities smashed by Super Typhoon Rai, but also some brilliant technological solutions to help emergency responders. For more details about this telecoms initiative, you can listen back to our interview with WFP's Patrick McKay, and that was from last November. If you remember, he was testing them, so it's wonderful to hear that the system is up and running for real. Now, let me turn to our regular guest, Solange Bejartegui-Cortez, for some literary inspiration about what we've just heard. Hi, Solange.
Hola, Daniel. ¿Cómo estás? As we heard from Brenda Barton from the UN World Food Programme, Super Typhoon Rai, locally known as Odette, has killed around 500 people and devastated so many lives. More than 7 million people have been affected in total. A very worrying situation. Odette is a monster, literally. It hit harder in remote communities where people knew that something big was coming. But as Brenda says, you can't prepare for the unknown. And Daniel, how do you prepare to lose everything anyway? How do you find the strength to rebuild after the storm? We may find a clue in a short novel written by Joseph Conrad called Typhoon. The story is about a ship facing extreme weather. Captain McWeir, the main character, lacks imagination. He is incapable of improvising and he likes to follow instructions. But the storm destroys them. The point is that the storm also creates the conditions that bring out other qualities in the ship's captain. As he says at the end, you don't find everything in books. Natural disasters will continue to hit the Philippines, and we know that with the climate crisis, they are becoming more unpredictable and extreme. We have to rebuild houses, but also our relationship with nature. We have to be creative and, above all, reduce inequality by being more inclusive, which is a key UN value. Let me finish by saying that it is unbearable to hear once again that women and girls have become even more vulnerable to sexual exploitation, human trafficking, and gender-based violence after this natural disaster. The super typhoon created the conditions for this violence to happen, but only because women were already vulnerable. And the fact that women are so vulnerable isn't fiction. We have to rebuild, yes, but let's rebuild safe houses and strong women.
Hear, hear, Solange. Thank you very much for that and the reference to Conrad's The Typhoon and Captain McQueer, who says you don't find everything in books. Well, my children would love that, but I'm not going to tell them about him at all. That is it from this week's show, listeners. Thank you so much, Solange, for being with us again. Dear listeners, we'll be back next week with more news and interviews from UN Catch Up Dateline Geneva. If you can't wait until then, UN News will be producing daily content on the UN News website. Please follow us and share it with your friends if you like it. Bye-bye for now.
Ciao, Daniel. Hasta pronto.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Global numbers of COVID-19 infection cases increased by 55% in the last week, the UN Health Agency said on Wednesday, while the weekly death toll was similar to the previous 7-day period. In total, the week from the 3rd to the 9th of January saw more than 15 million reported new cases of coronavirus and over 43,000 deaths. All regions reported an increase in infections except for Africa, which saw an 11% decrease. Southeast Asia registered the largest increase in cases last week, up more than 400%, followed by the Western Pacific, the Eastern Mediterranean, the Americas, and Europe. Latest World Health Organization data indicates that there have been 304 million confirmed cases and over 5.4 million deaths globally. The development comes after the UN Health Agency predicted that more than half of Europe will be infected with the Omicron variant within the next 6 to 8 weeks. Amid ongoing protests in Sudan at the military takeover last October, the UN Health Agency issued an alert on Wednesday over attacks on medical professionals, patients and facilities, blaming armed forces for at least two of the raids. The World Health Organization, WHO, said in a statement that the attacks had happened in Khartoum and elsewhere, a tactic that was last used against protesters during an uprising against longtime ruler Omar al-Bashir 3 years ago. The WHO warned that the two cases reportedly involving raids on healthcare facilities by military personnel were especially worrying, considering the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic and other public health threats. In one media report, witnesses said that soldiers fired tear gas into an emergency room at Khartoum Teaching Hospital that was treating injured protesters. In a statement condemning the targeted attacks, WHO Regional Director Dr. Ahmed Al-Madari described them as a flagrant violation of international humanitarian law. They must stop now, he insisted. In 2021, there were 26 recorded healthcare attacks in Sudan, in which 4 people died and 38 were injured, according to WHO. Since last October, the UN agency has distributed more than 850 rapid response kits containing essential medicines and medical supplies to Khartoum and several priority states, enough to treat 1.1 million people for 3 months. Finally, he's best known as Mr. Speed after his success in car racing, but these days John Todd, who's the special envoy for road safety, wants more people to take their foot off the pedal to save lives, especially in Africa. On Wednesday, Mr. Todd made an appeal to Zimbabwe to curb crashes and lives lost, which likely amount to 7,000 a year, according to latest UN data. Worryingly, this number is expected to triple in the next 10 years unless the government takes action, as recommended in a new UN road safety review of the country conducted by UN agencies UNECE and UNECA. The special envoy, who pledged to support road safety initiatives across Africa, noted that 90% of people and goods on the continent are moved by road, which provide access to jobs, education and healthcare. At the same time, Mr. Todd warned that Africa also sees the highest road traffic fatality rate in the world, while globally there are 1.3 million road deaths a year, meaning that road traffic injuries are the number one cause of death for people aged 5 to 29. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Matt Wells at UN News. A powerful and haunting exhibition featuring the Hibakusha, the Japanese survivors of the nuclear bombs that devastated Hiroshima and Nagasaki more than 3/4 of a century ago, has just been staged at UN headquarters in New York. It's not the first exhibit dedicated to the issue of nuclear disarmament that Japanese art director Eriko Platt has created for the UN. And although she's far too young to be a Hibakusha, she's proud to amplify their voices against the horrors of nuclear weapons. Ms. Platt explained to Liz Cafidi how her studies in Japan linked her to the right people who in turn helped highlight again the urgency of banning nuclear weapons, and what she describes as a strong, powerful and also beautiful exhibition that's the best she's done.
Well, originally I got involved in this exhibit because my mentor at art school in Tokyo in Japan, he is from Nagasaki, and he went to the same school as the head of Hidankyo, Mr. Terumi Tanaka. Hidankyo was very passionate about it since probably 2000, and they were doing proposals to the exhibit committee, but were denied because they were showing gruesome photos. I do everything with Hidankyo in the beginning, so I have to be a mediator to pick up which photographs are appropriate.
Can you walk us through how you found the photographs and the captions, of course, for the exhibition?
Hidankyo has a huge library. And then they send me the original pictures after they got a copyright from the photographers.
Did you select the photographs that went into the exhibition?
It's a joint, actually. They show me a couple of pictures for each panel, and then I'll pick with discussion with them.
What was your criteria?
I know I cannot show very graphic photographs. So if I think it's not appropriate for the lobby gallery, I would say no to them, and they find a gentler picture, and then I'll think about it, and okay, this is okay.
So they would make this suggestion, and then you would sign off on it or not?
Mm-hmm.
And what about the captions? Did they come with the photographs?
Originally, they provide me Japanese captions, so I provide rough translation to a writer and editor here, and she sometimes rewrite not only the captions, the main body text or the panel as well.
Since you've been working with the Hidankyo Library, have you grown particularly attached to nuclear disarmament as an issue?
Yes.
Can you describe maybe one photo in this exhibition that moves you?
Quite a few. Maybe a little boy holding a rice bowl, standing beside his mother. Both are slightly wounded. I think my mother's head was wrapped around some white cloth. Or next to it, the father figure soldier is holding a baby.
And what speaks to you about those two?
It tells us all those innocent people got instantly hurt or destroyed just by one bomb.
Have you personally spoken with any Hibakusha?
A lot, because Hidankyo is the organization of A-bomb and H-bomb survivors. For the last three times, at least 10 to 30 Hibakusha came to do live testimonials at the site, as well as outside of the United Nations, like churches, schools, and I accompany them and listen to them. But this time, because of the pandemic, no one could come.
How did that feel for you personally, coming from Japan?
Angry, I guess. It should never happen again. If they are not teaching, they should teach in a school and tell them what really happened.
Has having to mount this exhibition during the COVID pandemic brought with it any special challenges for you?
The preparation period was very short, so it was very hard for me to prepare. And a very small instance, Mr. Tsuboi died during this preparation, and I was including him as one of the survivors' panels. But since he died, I had to call the printing company and stop it and modify the text, because it was written in the present tense, to change present tense to the past tense. So I think I had like only 2 weeks for nearly 50 panels. Printing company, they said, oh, we need at least 2 weeks to print and make a panel. Yeah. So it was very tight.
Is there anything else you would like to add?
I wish media can come here to see, because it can raise some attention. I think this is the best exhibit I've done. Very strong, powerful, but in a way, beautiful, I think.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Deadly airstrikes in Ethiopia's Tigray region have reportedly left scores of displaced people dead and halted some relief work in the affected zone. UN Children's Fund UNICEF expressed outrage on Sunday after two airstrikes were reported late last week in northwest Tigray, apparently targeting camps for internally displaced persons and refugees. It is more than a year since clashes erupted in the northern region between federal government troops and forces loyal to the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, TPLF, creating a massive humanitarian disaster with millions facing acute hunger. UN Aid Coordination Office OCHA said that initial information indicated that one attack had targeted a camp in Dedebit town. Because of security and access issues, the number of casualties has not been verified. Despite reports that humanitarians have suspended activities in the area, Ocha stressed that some partners were continuing to operate around Dedibit amid an ongoing threat of drone strikes. Other aid partners have stopped elsewhere in the northwest because of fuel shortages, the UN office said. In a statement condemning the violence, UNICEF explained that attacks on refugee camps and other places such as schools that host displaced children and families may constitute a violation of international humanitarian law. Sudan's crisis can only be brought to an end through peaceful engagement by all parties. That's the message from UN negotiator Volker Perthes. It is time to end the violence and enter into a constructive process, said UN Special Representative for Sudan Perthes on Saturday, as he announced talks to bring together all key civilian and military stakeholders. The development comes after repeated mass protests across Sudan since last October, when a military takeover replaced a power-sharing agreement with civilian representatives, headed by former Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok. He resigned a week ago. The UN Rights Office, OHCHR, has previously expressed deep concern at the excessive use of violence against protesters who've been shot, while others have been reportedly raped or gang-raped. In a statement, Mr. Perthes explained that the UN-facilitated intra-Sudanese political process was being launched in consultation with Sudanese and international partners. Its aim is to support Sudanese stakeholders in agreeing on a way out of the current political crisis and also to agree on a sustainable path forward towards democracy and peace. To Greenland, where a new UN-endorsed report has found that for the 25th year running, its ice sheet lost more mass through summer melting than it gained back during the winter. The data from the Danish Arctic Monitoring Service, Polar Portal, shows that the early summer was cold and wet with unusually heavy and late snowfall in June, which delayed the onset of the melting season. After that, however, a heat wave at the end of July led to a considerable loss of ice. In all, the ice sheet lost around 166 billion tons during the 12-month period ending in August 2021. According to the Polar Portal report, which contributes to the work of the UN World Meteorological Organization, 2021 was also notable because there was rain at the top of the ice sheet at 3,200 meters rather than snow. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
I'm Deanne Penn with UN News. Amid daily mass protests in Sudan and the reported lethal shooting of three demonstrators in Khartoum on Thursday, the UN Rights Office, OHCHR, has urged the country's military rulers to respect people's fundamental freedoms. Tensions have been running high since generals seized power in a coup last October, and there have been daily protests since the resignation of Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok last weekend, as OHCHR's Saif Magango tells UN News' Daniel Johnson.
Well, what we know for sure is that the protests continue to take place. The organizations that are convening the protests continue to call for demonstrators to come into the streets and demand the restoration of civilian rule. They are very angry at the continued military hold on power, and they are determined to push for transition to civilian rule. You will recall that Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok resigned the 2nd of January, and there are plans afoot to have a new Prime Minister, but that has not yet been sorted out. On the human rights front, really, we continue to see a deterioration in the human rights situation. There are still many instances of security forces cracking down with excessive force of protests. Even yesterday, there were protests and they were broken up with tear gas and live bullets.
It is very disturbing, and since Independence Day on the 1st of January, great crowds of people have been trying to get into the centre of Khartoum. What is it that you're trying to achieve now to calm the situation, perhaps?
What we are really trying to achieve is to impress on the authorities in Sudan to respect the obligations under international law on human rights, to ensure that there is no excessive use of force, to investigate cases of excessive use of force, cases of sexual violence, and other such acts that have taken place since the 25th of October when the coup took place. So for us, really, we continue to express concern about this and to urge the authorities to refrain from using these kinds of means to allow and guarantee and protect the right to freedom of assembly.
On the accountability, you say that you're hoping to get some accountability processes underway since the October coup by the military. But going back further, of course, there was the massacre in June 2019. There's a sit-in protest outside the army's headquarters, and people are still furious about that. So what kind of engagement and negotiations and contact do you have with the military?
So I'm not sure what kind of contact there is with the military, but you'll have heard that the independent expert, independent human rights expert Adama Dieng, be traveling to Sudan the next week or so to try and hold discussions with the authorities in Sudan to really try to continue to push the authorities to respect their human rights obligations. Yes, you're right that the population in Sudan is quite angry at the moment, even the whole world can see it in the protests that continue almost on a daily basis. And they are not only angry about the coup and the deal that was agreed between the military and the prime minister recently, and the prime minister's subsequently the prime minister's resignation, but they are angry about human rights violations that have taken place, even historically, going as far as those protests that were broken down at the square outside the military building following the overthrow of President al-Bashir in 2019. So it has been a build-up of anger, frustration, and grievance in Sudan. And the way the authorities are dealing with it at the moment leaves a lot to be desired. It's only fomenting the situation further and building onto that grievance and making it worse. So we hold at the Office of the Commissioner for Human Rights that without respect for human rights and guaranteeing fundamental freedoms, there's no way to resolve the situation without ensuring that human rights are respected.
And on those freedoms, those fundamental freedoms that you're mentioning, there are reports of information blackouts. Do you have the latest on that?
Yes, indeed. We continue to really be concerned about the disruption of telecommunications and the internet, despite the fact that the Khartoum District Court recently directed all telecoms to immediately restore the internet and not disrupt it further pending court proceedings. The internet continues to be disrupted before and during protests, despite that there being a court order against that. That is in stark violation of the law, and basically continues to undermine the right to freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, and also people's ability to communicate and to transact and to even access healthcare in these difficult times of COVID-19. So that is something also that needs to be addressed by the authorities to make sure that it doesn't go on and violate people's rights.
And final question to you, Saif Maganga, from the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. If there is to be accountability afterwards, the Office of the High Commissioner is going to need some sort of evidence-based data to move ahead with.
Yes, indeed. So we have the Joint Human Rights Office in Sudan, which updates us. And the UN has a big presence even beyond the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, which also shares information with us from Darfur, from Khartoum, and other parts of the country. So we are quite well briefed about what's going on, and we continue to be quite concerned about the whole gamut of violations that are taking place in the country. We hope that the upcoming visit by the independent expert to Sudan, Mr. Adama Dieng, will go some way towards discussions with the government to see that the response to the protest, to the whole crisis, is a human rights respecting response rather than a repressive one that will only further enrage and create grievance among the Sudanese people.
This is the News in Brief from the United Nations. Super Typhoon Rai, which ripped through the Philippines over Christmas, has created a massive emergency with huge and ongoing needs, UN humanitarians said on Friday. Communities are still reeling from the effects of the typhoon, which made landfall in no less than 9 places across an area the size of Austria and killed some 500 people. It is being compared to Typhoon Haiyan in 2013, which killed more than 6,000 and left 4 million homeless. Here's Brenda Barton from the World Food Programme, WFP, describing the devastation that humanitarians have encountered.
It just ripped across an area that is enormous caused just really raising things to the ground, houses to the ground. The area that I saw, there was no building that was untouched, no house without a roof, like all houses without roofs. And it was heartbreaking because it was on Christmas Eve when the Filipino community comes together and celebrates Christmas and goes to Christmas Mass.
To support the relief effort, the UN has launched a $107 million appeal. WFP has requested $25 million of this for food, logistics and telecoms. To date, however, the agency has received $4.7 million, 3 weeks since the crisis began. The Omicron COVID variant should not be considered mild, and it is still killing people. That's the stark message from the World Health Organization, WHO, after the highest weekly number of coronavirus infections yet recorded. In a press conference from Geneva, WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus repeated his call for vaccine equity, as people who have been vaccinated have the best protection from all forms of the virus. Ahead of the Winter Games in China next month, the UN Health Agency also said that it saw no particular extra COVID risk associated with holding them, despite recent outbreaks in the country. Here's the WHO's Health Emergencies Executive Director, Dr. Mike Ryan.
China has been experiencing some pretty large outbreaks of coronavirus, or COVID-19, over the last number of weeks, and you'll see that the authorities in China are taking a very strong approach to dealing with those outbreaks. So we will continue to monitor the situation, but certainly at this stage, given the arrangements that have been put in place for the athletes and by the organisers, we don't perceive that there's any particular extra risk in hosting or running the games.
Amid reports of deadly violence linked to protests in Kazakhstan, UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet has issued an appeal for security forces, demonstrators and others to refrain from violence. All those with grievances should seek a peaceful resolution to the emergency, Ms. Bachelet said on Thursday evening. Her comments came after police in the main city of Almaty said that security forces had killed dozens of protesters, as media reports described intense shooting between the military and armed individuals in front of the city hall. Hundreds have reportedly been injured in the protests, which began on the 2nd of January after now reversed fuel price hikes. In a statement, the UN rights chief said that international law was clear. People have the right to peaceful protest. But she added that no one, no matter how angry or aggrieved they may be, should resort to violence against others. Daniel Johnson, UN News. Hello, in our first show of 2022, the fight goes on for oil-rich Marib in northern Yemen, and so does the struggle to help all those who've been repeatedly displaced by the conflict. We'll hear how UN Migration Agency IOM is doing everything it can in difficult and dangerous conditions. Journalists are under fire too, UNESCO tells us, while on the COVID front line, the World Health Organization has just announced that for the moment at least, there's no particular risk associated with holding next month's Winter Games in Beijing. And after days of nationwide protest in Kazakhstan, UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet has issued a call for calm. That's all coming up in the next 15 minutes or so on UN Catch-Up Dateline Geneva with me, Daniel Johnson, and Solange Berhetegui-Cortez. Thanks for listening. First, the news. Amid reports of deadly violence linked to protests in Kazakhstan, UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet has issued an appeal for security forces, demonstrators and others to refrain from violence. All those with grievances should seek a peaceful resolution to the emergency, Ms. Bachelet said on Thursday evening. Her comments came after police in the city of Almaty said that security forces had killed dozens of protesters, while media reports also on Thursday described intense shooting between the military and armed individuals in front of Almaty City Hall. Almost 1,000 people have reportedly been injured in the protests, which began on the 2nd of January after fuel price hikes. In a statement, the UN rights chief said that international law was clear, people have the right to peaceful protest. But she added that no one, no matter how angry or aggrieved they may be, should resort to violence against others. According to the Kazakh authorities, 12 law enforcement officers have died in the unrest and more than 300 police officers and National Guard troops have been injured. The UN Health Agency said on Thursday that it sees no particular extra COVID risk associated with the upcoming Winter Games in China. At a scheduled press briefing in Geneva, the World Health Organization's Health Emergencies Executive Director, Dr. Mike Ryan, said that he was confident that the measures put in place by Beijing were very strict and very strong.
China has been experiencing some pretty large outbreaks of coronavirus, or COVID-19, over the last number of weeks, and you'll see that the authorities in China are taking a very strong approach to dealing with those outbreaks. So we will continue to monitor the situation, but certainly at this stage, given the arrangements that have been put in place for the athletes and by the organisers, we don't perceive that there's any particular extra risk in hosting or running the games. But obviously we will keep all of the measures that are being put in place under constant review.
Head of the UN Health Agency, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, said that last week saw the highest number of COVID-19 cases reported so far in the pandemic, but that the true number was far higher. The WHO chief repeated his call for vaccine equity and noted that although the Omicron variant does appear to be less severe compared to Delta, especially in those vaccinated, it should not be categorized as mild. Just like previous variants, Omicron is hospitalizing people and it is killing people, Tedros warned. 55 journalists and media professionals were killed last year, the UN said on Thursday, adding that nearly 9 in 10 killings since 2006 are still unresolved. Impunity is alarmingly widespread, said the UN Scientific, Education and Cultural Organization, UNESCO. Although the number of victims is the lowest in a decade, UNESCO pointed to the many dangers that reporters face. These include high rates of imprisonment, physical attack, intimidation and harassment, including when covering protests. 2/3 of the victims died in countries not in the grip of armed conflict, which the agency said highlighted the continued dangers faced by journalists in their daily reporting. Here's UNESCO's Claire O'Hagan.
As our Director General Audrey Azoulay said, once again in 2021, far too many journalists paid the ultimate price to bring truth to light. Right now, the world needs independent, factual information more than ever. We must do more to ensure that those who work tirelessly to provide this can do so without fear.
Most deaths took place in just 2 regions, Asia Pacific with 23 killings and Latin America and the Caribbean with 14. The headlines there, and now to this week's interview with Christa Rottensteiner, who's Chief of Mission for UN Migration Agency IOM in Yemen. The agency is at the sharp end of the country's bitter conflict that has seen the government pushed out of the capital Sana'a by mainly Houthi opposition forces. Oil-rich Marib Governorate is the government's last stronghold in the north of Yemen, but it has become the focus of deadly fighting and aerial attacks. So let's hear from Christa now, who describes how these armed clashes have had a catastrophic impact on communities, driving displacement and humanitarian needs at an unprecedented rate.
I've been working in Yemen for over 2 years now, and I have to say I've never seen the situation as desperate as it is now, especially in Marib Governorate. And this is why IOM wanted to sound the alarm about the worsening humanitarian situation. What we're seeing on the ground is that there is continued fighting. Since September particularly, we've seen waves of displacement arrive in the city. And it's important to remember that Marib is a place where about 1 million of people have found refuge during the last 6 years of conflict. So they arrive there because there is more stability. And that already has put an enormous pressure on the services of this city, which was only built for a few hundred thousand. But now with this increasing numbers of displaced people, this is making the situation even more difficult.
And just to get an idea, there are, what, more than 60 sites for displaced people that the IOM, the UN Migration Agency, looks after. So that gives you an idea of the scale, doesn't it?
Indeed, the scale is enormous. We estimate that there is now 137 sites. But as you say, we cannot reach all of them. IOM is working in over 60 of them, but it is a very difficult situation, and we've seen a tenfold increase of the numbers that arrive in these sites. So people are lacking the absolute basics. I've just come back from Marib, and I was really shocked to see the situation there. I've spoken to mothers who have been displaced 5 times. So one particular woman really, you know, it was really sad to talk to her. She's a widow. She has 4 children. And it's now the fifth time that she's in a displacement site, and she doesn't know whether she'll be able to stay there because of the conflict coming closer and closer to the city. So it's really these personal tragedies that affect us. IOM is doing its best to help. We reach over 200,000 people in Marib, or have reached already, but there is so much more. There are so many people who we cannot help even with the most basics. We support with food, with water, with shelter, and we also provide healthcare, particularly with the mobile teams. But it is very difficult and it is very dangerous helping people who live quite close to the front line.
I'm sure it is, and there are reports that there are attacks, daily attacks from the west, the north and the south. So how can your humanitarian teams actually get in and ensure their safety before they can help others?
Yes, the situation is dangerous. We obviously need to keep our staff safe. They try to reach as close to the front line as they can whilst remaining safe. So there are quite a number of sites now that we cannot reach anymore. Some of them had to be abandoned. And that also makes it very difficult for us as humanitarians to find more sustainable solutions, because ideally we don't want to just provide water trucking in a site. We want to establish a functioning water system, but that's very difficult when people have to flee many times and some of the camps have to be abandoned.
Now, you're the UN Migration Agency, so maybe you could tell us about the migration movement through Yemen, which seems incredible given that there is this conflict going on, this terrible conflict that's been going on for years, but there are many migrants still moving to the Gulf states. Do you have an idea of numbers still?
Yes, indeed. It is surprising that there are still tens of thousands of migrants arriving. Before COVID, this was actually the world's busiest maritime route. So people coming from the Horn of Africa trying to reach Saudi Arabia for work. We had over 140,000 people coming. Now, the numbers have dropped dramatically since COVID, about 80%, but we still see tens of thousands of migrants arriving. They're in the vast majority young Ethiopian men who are looking for jobs. And they often get stuck in Yemen, and they're particularly vulnerable. So even though Yemenis are very generous, it's still overwhelming the services. And because they don't speak the language, they find it very difficult to make a living. So we estimate that over 30,000 people at least are stuck in Yemen. And as IOM, we provide them with minimal support to ensure their survival, with healthcare, with food. And when it is possible, we also try to support them to return home if that's feasible. And we're particularly concerned about women to whom we have very little access because they're often in the hands of the smugglers, very reliant on them for their onward movement, and they're very much controlled, and often there's extortion and exploitation.
Yes, it's a terrible situation. It's been described as the world's largest humanitarian crisis. So how much funding does the UN Migration Agency, IOM, actually need for the coming months?
Yeah, as you say, this is the largest humanitarian crisis. We have two-thirds of the population in need, so that's 20 million people, and 4 million of them have been displaced, so they're particularly vulnerable, as I described in Marib, for example. We have only received 50% of the funding needs, so every year the United Nations makes a funding appeal, and we've only received half of that. So this makes it very hard to respond to even the most basic needs of the population. Same for IOM. We have asked for 170 million and we've only received half of that. So it makes it very difficult to support the poorest and those who are in greatest needs.
Finally, maybe we could just go back quickly to the sustainable solutions for people's daily needs. If you could give us an idea about how the UN Migration Agency manages to help them with technology, for example, that would be good to know.
IOM is working increasingly to try to look at sustainable solutions because there are areas in Yemen where there is more stability. So we try to repair infrastructure as much as we can, schools, hospitals, and also doing this in a very conflict-sensitive way. So for example, if we know that there is a conflict over a water source in a community, we try to bring the communities together, also empowering women in this process, try to get them together to agree on a way forward and also to repair the infrastructure. Then that way, we don't only improve what's there for the community in a longer term, but also trying to resolve local conflicts because they can blow up and they can create more difficulties. And we're also looking at solar technology because this is clearly in a country with a lot of sunshine, is bringing solutions rather than using diesel. So wherever we can, we install solar panels so that in displaced camps, people can have the electricity that's needed in an ecological way.
My thanks then to Krista Rottensteiner for joining us on the show. Her team told me that in December alone, missiles landed in 3 displacement sites hosting 566 households, leaving 4 children and 1 woman injured by shrapnel. Not good. Now, let me turn to our regular guest, Solange Perteguy-Cortez, who's with us again for her personal take on all this. Hi, Solange.
Hola, Daniel. A word comes to mind. Flow. Flow of images, words, human flows, financial flows, migratory flows, a bad flow. As we heard, Yemen is one of the largest humanitarian crises and yet one of the worst places in the world to be a woman. We recently asked here on UN Catch-Up, what happened on Yemen? Where are the fantastic stories imagined centuries ago? Today, Yemen is inhabited by the new queens of Sheba. And they really aren't legendary, Daniel. The new queens of Sheba are refugees. They are fleeing war, hunger, and violence. In a way, we are all migrants. I myself come from Bolivia, but migrant is a word that has several meanings, depending on the person who carries it. Migrants do not all have the same possibilities. Someone who's forced to migrate has lost the liberty. There is a writer who I love so much. His name is Amin Malouf. And in his book, Le Naufrage des Civilisations, he quoted a Spanish-Algerian writer, Omayya Ibn Abisalt al-Andalusi, who said, "If I am made of clay, the whole earth is my country, and all creatures are my kin." We have to turn the bad flow into a good one, a flow of solidarity. As the Secretary General Antonio Guterres said on the occasion of the International Migrants Day, solidarity with migrants has never been more urgent.
Thank you very much indeed, Solange. It has been a busy show, so it's time to wrap this up. Thank you, listeners. We will be back next week with more UN stories from around the world. Do join us if you can. But until then, don't forget to check out UN News for daily stories and bulletins. Bye-bye for now.